welcome to the Pro Football Weekly Podcast in Week 11. So glad that you are back with us. Full show today. Ty Shalter, Pro Football Weekly contributor, will be on momentarily to break down his great weekly column on the website, The Hot Read, and definitely head over to profootballweekly.com to check out all of his work as well as all of mine. And, of course, all of Hub Arkish's, our content director, our publisher and editor, as he does each week, he'll be joining the podcast later on to let us know a couple of the most interesting angles from his vantage point in Week 11. So, going to dive right in with our great guests, but before we do, a quick reminder. If you haven't done so already, we'd love it if you head over to iTunes and subscribe to the Pro Football Weekly Podcast. And while you're there, we definitely appreciate the ratings, and any comments or feedback that you want to give can only help this podcast. So that is definitely appreciated. And as I mentioned, it's an interesting slate in Week 11. And to break it all down, first, we'd like to welcome in Ty Shalter.
For those who don't already know, you can find Ty's work at Vice Sports, The Comeback, and certainly at ProFootballWeekly.com, where he does his weekly Hot Read column. Also a football talker, as he puts it, on Sirius XM. And here talking football with us, Ty, what's good? What's new today?
Oh, man, you know, another great day, another great week of football in the NFL. Got some Thursday night action tonight. Can't wait to get to that.
Yeah, you know, I think if fans of Thursday night football, or I don't even know if fans is the right way of putting it, but I think there should probably be some points in store this evening, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I'd hope so. I would hope so. Certainly would think so, given the two teams, you know, Saints and Panthers. This is a game that's very, very important for both these teams. And they both can put up points in bunches, and they both give up a lot of points. So hoping this will be a little bit better than the Browns-Ravens classic we had last week.
Yeah, they set the bar pretty high for sure. We're taping here mid-Thursday afternoon. I don't know whether my producers will get this podcast up in time for Thursday night, so we won't delve into that matchup too much, but right. I do want to go over your latest Hot Read column. It's appointment reading for me every week, and you lead week. Yeah, of course. We're thrilled to have you on board at PFW and offering lots of great content. So, you know, you lead with a matchup that's interesting. I think one that's under the radar in the Rams-Dolphins game. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about one person in particular that Jared Goff better get a lot of help from if he's to survive his NFL debut?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, Jared Goff. This is now the face of the Los Angeles Rams franchise. Just today, there was a groundbreaking ceremony in L.A. Roger Goodell, Stan Kroenke, they got shovels in the dirt. In 2 years, this is going to be the crown jewel of the NFL, and this guy is supposed to be the guy leading the way for that franchise, and he is going up against a Miami Dolphins defensive line anchored by Ndamukong Suh. Obviously, you know, the Dolphins have some talent up front, and the Rams have really struggled along the offensive line. Left tackle Greg Robinson's been a big issue the whole time. And then on the interior, they've had a really inconsistent play. But there's one guy, Roger Saffold, the left guard, who has actually stepped up over the past few weeks. They had the bye week a couple weeks ago, but he's had some much better performances. And then last week, I thought he did really, really well against the New York Jets, against Muhammad Wilkerson. And as I said in the piece, you know, nobody really says, wow, the guard had a great game if they're right. Not watching the tape a couple days after. But if Monday morning all the Jets headlines are like, where was the defensive line at? Where was the interior pressure? Muhammad Wilkerson had a bad day at the office. Then you can turn around and go, well, somebody must have done pretty good up front for the Rams. Right. And in my opinion, it was Saffold. So he's going to be a guy that, whether we're talking about helping the center, whether we're talking about helping the left tackle, whether we're talking about holding his own in the run game, he's going to have to open up some holes too. A lot of burden will be on him, but we know he's a talented guy. They paid him basically left tackle money a couple years ago. He's going to have to earn that this week to protect Jared Goff.
Ty, before we talk about Goff a little bit and what took so long and what to expect next for him, what to expect first from him, I guess I should say, do you remember the background with Roger Saffold? Wasn't there a failed free agent signing before he landed back with the Rams? Do you recall that story? It's kind of vague for me.
The way this broke down, and I remember well because for a while there on Bleacher Report, they had me do, I think it was 3 or 4 years in a row, they had me basically pull you know, write for like 36 hours in 2 days around the free agent signing day. But Roger Saffold, the way it broke down was the Raiders had him in.
That's what I thought. The Raiders
offered him like a big, not top of the market, but close to the top of the market left tackle deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically he quote unquote failed the physical. And what that kind of, you know, reading between the lines came down to was Reggie McKenzie, you know, the general manager said, we're going to make this deal. And then the owner said, no, we're not. Okay. So that's what a lot of the reporters speculated at the time. I don't have firsthand direct knowledge of those negotiations, but failed physical basically means the franchise as a whole decided not to take a risk on the guy. There's no, you know, universal standard for failed physical. So he goes back to St. Louis and they give him sort of 90% of that contract because they still thought he was going to be a right tackle, mm-hmm. Make tackle money. Then they draft Rob Havenstein because the tackle thing wasn't working out. They shift Saffold into guard, and he's been, as I said, up and down, mostly down since then, but it was a wild 24. And then that was preceded also, if memory serves, by the Raiders letting Gerald Veldheer, who was perceived as an up and coming great left tackle, walk to the Arizona Cardinals. Then they sign Saffold to replace him. Then they spike the physical. Then he goes back to St. Louis, and the Raiders end up losing a game of musical chairs. So that was one of the great dramas of NFL free agency the last few years.
What a long, strange trip it's been for both of those offensive lines. And I'm not talking about St. Louis to Los Angeles and soon Oakland to Las Vegas, but just where those lines are at now after a few kind of tumultuous years. But Ty, I'm horribly ADD, and you'll learn that about me if you didn't already just by doing this podcast together. So I do want to talk golf, but because my mind's always racing in 12 different places, I did have one more thought. You mentioned Greg Robinson and his struggles, a former top five pick, I think number two overall. And it just got me to thinking, what are your thoughts on the hit rate of offensive tackles in the draft and maybe compared to where it used to be? I know guys like Taylor Decker, and you can speak to this well, we'll talk Lions here in a little bit. Sure. And certainly Jack Conklin, some other guys having some success this season. But would you say that position's a little bit dicier proposition drafting way up high compared to where it used to be?
Absolutely. And I did this. I know I've done at least – I did one big, long study about all the draft positions about 3-4 years ago. And I think I specifically looked at offensive linemen a couple years ago, basically going, okay, there's this notion that – offensive line is a can't miss position. You know, right. If you draft a guard in the first round, that's going to be a Pro Bowl guard for 10 years. You know, if you are up that high and there's not a quarterback you like, if you're in the top five picks, top 10 picks, and there's not a player you love, just grab the tackle because the tackle is going to be great. Well, really, the hit rate is basically the same as every other position. And there's a laundry list of guys that had the look, that had the body, that had even the college production that just didn't translate to the NFL. It's not an automatic thing. And I think partly we go to the entire college to NFL pipeline when we say they're not getting as much experience, they're not staying as long, the sure. schemes are not conducive to it, offensive line play especially. They're not getting the technique background, mm-hmm. they're not getting that foundation. You come to the NFL and, well, you know, sorry, just being 6'6", 315, 6'4", 325, whatever it is, doesn't mean you automatically get to be a great offensive lineman in the NFL. So a lot of these guys, they're also getting overdrafted, especially guards. We've seen it with Jonathan Cooper, we've seen it with Chance Warmack, mm-hmm. David DeCastro took a few years. A lot of these guys, we start talking about, oh, well, you know, if you can take him at 20, why can't you take him at 15? If you can take him at 15, why can't you take him at 10? If you can take him at 10, why can't you take him at 5? Well, the end of the result is they have the same hit or miss rate as just about everybody else, sure. and then the guard doesn't give you the positional value. So certainly offensive linemen, it's this idea that it's a safe pick, or, you know, that if you swing high on a left tackle like Greg Robinson or like even, you know, Roger Saffold, he wasn't I think he was 18th. He was a mid-teens guy if you years back. If you miss, you kick him in and he's a great guard.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, not necessarily, especially with today's left tackles, those pass protectors. You take a guy like Matt Khalil, you know, he's 6'4", 6'5", 305. That's not a guard. He doesn't have a guard body type. He doesn't have the anchor. You know, he can't push. He can't drive block. He's never asked to drive block in college. A lot of these athletic left tackles, athletic pass protectors, you know, no, that doesn't just automatically translate. And so that idea that it's a safe pick, I think, is totally bogus.
Good stuff. We could certainly do a separate podcast on the state of O-line play around the NFL, but we will save that one for another day. Ty, I think this is a decent segue, though, just kind of sticking with hit rates at the top of the draft and recent first overall picks in, you know, say Jameis Winston or Andrew Luck, Cam Newton, I think are probably the last three top overall quarterbacks we've had initial success. Jared Goff, we don't know yet, obviously. Just your initial thoughts on what took so long? Did it take so long? Is that kind of our expectation now after seeing some of these recent guys? Do you think the Rams have handled this the right way? And do you think Goff has a chance for some early success beyond what Roger Saffold does versus Ndamukong Suh? A lot there to unpack, I know.
Yeah. So for me, the Rams, you know, they go out with Goff, and fair enough. You know, if that's the guy that...
Was he your guy? Were you Goff or Wentz? Let's start there.
Gosh, great question. I think I liked Wentz better just because I didn't necessarily see... Not only did I not see the upside with Goff, right, I wasn't convinced. There's this idea that Goff was more NFL ready, and I wasn't convinced of that. You know, at the Senior Bowl, Carson Wentz did some stuff, and I went, okay, at least this guy, I can see where he has that path to the NFL. I thought he would have, you know, everyone was comparing him to Roethlisberger, and I thought that was a fair comparison where he could go in and have a serviceable rookie year on a good team and over 2-3 years build up into the guy that you really hope he can become. If you make it easy for him, it'll work. With Goff, you go, okay, he's on the weird, you know, one read spread offense. I'm looking at his throws and looking at his decision making, especially it was really the Stanford tape that I went back and watched those cut ups. And I was like, here is a physical defense, an NFL style defense, right, and a big game, and just bad throw after bad throw. I don't see the footwork. I don't see the calm, the poise, the decision making you expect. And so I went, okay, there's potential here, but I don't see a number one overall franchise guy. But if you let's say I'm wrong, I've been wrong on plenty of guys, so everybody is. So you go, okay, Los Angeles Rams, this is a face of our franchise. We've got Jeff Fisher. You know, we know that he brought along Steve McNair slowly. You know, we know that he's handled this franchise relocation. We know that you know, there may be a timetable, and again, we talk about training camp. The one thing that really got me on Goff was after they drafted him during training camp, Jeff Perlman, who, you know, is a great writer, a novelist, does special projects for Bleacher Report, freelances everywhere, has his own site. He posted a little clip. He went to training camp with his son and he went, oh, look at this great throw by Goff. Mm-hmm. But what interested me was pre-snap, he had the video running. Goff comes to the line, calls out a cadence, and then you hear laughter. And then you hear, and like, and it definitely sounds like it's big, heavy NFL dudes laughing far away from the camera.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he made call the thing, and like his offensive line, his teammates went, that's not even a call, dude. Right. Like they just started laughing because it was not a thing. And so he kind of, called a different play. And yeah, the throw went for a touchdown. But I went, this is the big problem with him, is that he is not ready and everybody knows it. Like, he's not ready to come to a line with a play call, read a defense, check into or out of anything else, make any kind of decisions based on what he's seeing. Mm-hmm. So, because he never really had to do that in college. And so that's going to, and he's not taking to it. You know, some guys can take to it, but he's not taking to it quickly. And so for me, I think the big problem was fans having the expectation of, okay, great, Case Keenum, he's a tomato can. He's just there for Jared Goff to look good against and you know, just walk over on his way to the starting job, and it didn't happen. Yeah. And then Case Keenum was voted a captain. And I went, okay, so the team does not believe that Jared Goff is ready. They believe Case Keenum's the guy. So if there was a timetable all along, they needed to come out with it. I asked Amy Trask that a little while ago, and she kind of favorited the tweet but didn't give me an answer on Twitter. Like, doesn't it help, you know, to just go, hey, look, we've got a timetable on him. Be patient. You know, this is a long-term plan. This is a 2-3 year thing. But then, of course, we have the tension of, does Jeff Fisher have the mandate? Does Les Snead have the mandate? Do they know that they're going to be here next year if Jared Goff doesn't bail them out? Right. And so you go back and look at this schedule and you go, okay, we're debuting against Ndamukong Suh and the Miami Dolphins, who are playing great, by the way. I'm pulling up the Rams schedule right now, but this is brutal. So they got the Dolphins at the Superdome against the Saints, at Gillette Stadium, hosting the Falcons, at CenturyLink against the Seahawks.
Oh,
I mean, that's as tough a five-game schedule as any team is going to play all year long in the NFL, and that's what Jared Goff is going to have to come in and face. So did they handle it right? I mean, I guess we'll see. Vinny Bonsignor from the LA Daily News said Goff's looked good in practice this week. Maybe they've got a plan. Maybe they've got something together. I would hope they would have some game plans and packages together. So maybe he'll come out and have a good first game, get some confidence under his feet, but he's going to take a lot of hits and throw some picks over these next five games, and we'll learn a lot about his mental makeup.
At least he has Tavon Austin. Crickets. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. The Rams make it too darn easy. They really do. But yeah, and that's interesting to hear you say. You know, after New Orleans, obviously they're not playing a whole lot of defense, and actually the Patriots aren't either. But Foxborough and the Clink, I think, are probably the two rowdiest and toughest environments to go to, and those will be two of his first three road trips. So hey, it'll be nothing if not interesting, and that's maybe more than we could say about the Rams offense than we have in a long time. So it should be fun. Ty, let's move forward. Green Bay, sure. Washington is the game you highlight in your hot read. You did say that Philly going into Seattle, probably the most glamorous matchup of the weekend. But Green Bay, Washington, a lot riding on it for both of these clubs, particularly Mike McCarthy's Packers. What do you think? Can they turn the season around? It'll be another kind of very general loaded question for you, but do you think that there's more pressure this week on that offense going into Washington, or is it the defense after they just absolutely stunk it up in Nashville?
Great question. You know, because right now, I mean, Aaron Rodgers statistically, you look at his last few games especially, is right there with his career averages. I mean, even counting, I mean, he put up some stinkers in the first couple of weeks. He's still at 6% touchdown rate, 1.9% interception rate, 93.9 passer rating. You know, those are all underperforming his career averages, but overperforming the career averages of about 95% of starting NFL quarterbacks over the past 15, 20 years. So Aaron Rodgers can still spin it, and he can still make points happen. The defense is a big question. That egg they laid dropped them down to 24th in terms of scoring defense. They're allowing 26 points a game, 1.2 more per game than they are scoring, and that is getting outscored is not a place the Green Bay Packers are used to being. Then you turn around in Washington, Kirk Cousins has been taking care of the ball. I thought that was the best thing to see Kirk Cousins do against that Minnesota Vikings defense. I mean, we are talking about one of the best defenses in the NFL. Not only was he able to score points and throw the ball, but he avoided turnovers doing it. And that's been kind of, you either get the cautious Kirk Cousins who can't put points on the board, but at least manages to avoid turnovers, or you like that Kirk Cousins who's throwing it all over and you know, you're going to get a pick or two in with your two or three touchdowns. And we didn't see that. He took care of the ball and scored the points and opened up a lead. And that was great to see. But then that's even more trouble for a Packers defense that got shredded by Marcus Mariota, Tajae Sharpe, and Rashard Matthews last week. They had absolutely no answer for those guys. Oh, and DeMarco Murray flea flicker, of course. Halfback pass. Halfback pass. So, you know, right now, Dom Capers has a lot to answer for. I think pass rush is a big question. You know, guys like Clay Matthews and Julius Peppers have been, you know, stars coming off the edge and coming up the middle. And right now they've got this sort of good run stopping front seven that can't get pressure, and that's not a way to beat teams, especially when you don't have a superstar laden secondary.
Right, and one that's been banged up, obviously, and you know, like you said, I think Washington's skill talent is better than Tennessee's. Rashard Matthews, Tajae Sharpe, not really scaring anyone, although Delanie Walker, obviously a really good player. What about the Washington defense? Preston Smith's coming out party last week. Ryan Kerrigan has come on very strong over the past month or even a little longer. And it seems like Joe Barry has made some adjustments. He was taking a lot of heat early with the way Josh Norman didn't see. I don't even remember what was it, Antonio Brown, which wide receiver he didn't see on that side of the field all game. And it seems like they've adjusted a little bit since. Are you buying what Washington is doing defensively? And do you think they're kind of built to stick in this NFC East that all of a sudden looks like one of the better divisions in football?
You know, I have been impressed, and number one, I'm kind of a Ryan Kerrigan guy. Yeah. I'm kind of a, you know, I don't think we recognize, and part of it is I think every time he's had a really dominant stretch of like 2, 3, 4 games where he gets 2, 3, 4 sacks, makes a couple big plays, then he gets hurt and misses a few games. It's like every time he gets a little heat around him, then he gets hurt and it cools off, or Washington is just irrelevant or terrible or whatever it is. You know, we get distracted by whatever the latest quarterback circus is. But he's really been, over the past few years, an excellent outside linebacker, and he was really phenomenal against Minnesota. So, yeah, that's part of it. I think overall the secondary, you know, moving some guys around, you know, Bashaud Breeland recovered after a rough first couple of games, like you alluded to. I think they understand how to use Josh Norman better. You know, moving D Hall back to safety was something I was really interested to see. Unfortunately, we didn't get to see much of that experiment. But some of the guys back there, you know, have really been filling in quite well. It's been kind of a platoon thing with the safeties, and you know, Whitner and Iheanacho. I can never remember. Iheanacho. Yeah. So you know, they've been getting things done, but really, it's been the front seven that's been able to keep them in games and shut down the run and get a little bit of pressure when they need it. So again, you turn around and look at Aaron Rodgers. Do they have the horses to match up with the Packers? And at first you call Jordy Nelson, Randall Cobb, you know, you run down this line of players, but these guys haven't been getting open. And I know the narrative is kind of, oh, Jordy Nelson, he's back. But it's really been one or two plays each of these games. A lot of his touchdowns have been red zone touchdowns, or you know, there was one where he was completely uncovered, literally doing jumping jacks in the middle of the end zone. nobody bothered covering me. Throw it to me. You know, and not to rag on Jordy Nelson, who's a great player, but this is not 2014, 2013 Jordy Nelson right now. And Randall Cobb has really struggled. They have struggled to use him well. I think defenses know the book on Randall Cobb. And especially on how Mike McCarthy uses Randall Cobb, he's just not dangerous right now. He's not getting open. They're not finding ways to get him the ball. And the same thing you talk about the running backs. Losing Eddie Lacy, I think, really nuked the Packers offensively because they don't have an answer. They don't have a backup. They don't have anybody who can reliably get yards. And then when you have no balance and the answer is just, okay, well, Aaron, throw it 50 times and be good enough at it that you just overcome everything else that's wrong with this team. That's not going to work very often, especially when you start coming down the stretch in November and December against a bunch of good teams that are trying to beat you.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. You end your column with a little bit of hot seat talk, and I want to get there. I didn't intend on this being a real NFC North-centric podcast, but sometimes it just kind of goes that way, and I do want to ask you quickly about the Cardinals and Vikings. Jeremiah Searles, you're under the radar player of the week on that Vikings offensive line. He's about the 12th or 13th guy up at this point. And all he gets in his I don't think it'll be his first start, but in a big spot after losing Jake Long. We don't know what spot he'll be in yet, but we do know he's going to get an uber aggressive Arizona defense. Chandler Jones, Marcus Golden, a lot of playmakers. Two teams, much like Green Bay and Washington, two teams that don't have a lot of breathing room at this point. How do you kind of handicap Arizona going into Minnesota Sunday?
Yeah, it's a fascinating matchup. Fascinating matchup, and basically a must win for both teams. These are two teams. I mean, it's fair to say we could have circled this at the beginning of the year as a potential NFC championship game, given what Minnesota did last year. They were a Blair Walsh shank away from getting to the second round. We knew they were going to be better this year. And then the same thing with Arizona. You know, the last 2 years have each been Arizona's year, and then until they weren't. So this was a fascinating matchup. And like you said, this defense brings a lot of heat. They've got a lot of power and speed up in the front seven, and it's a Vikings defense offensive line that's absolutely in disarray. And like you said, whether they shift left guard Alex Boone off to left tackle and put Searles in at left guard, whether they swap TJ Clemmings back over to the left side. I mean, he's much better on the right. He's been on the right. He's comfortable on the right. They've had to play him on the left before. If they swap him over to the left, my guess is that's what they do, despite Alex Boone publicly lobbying in the media for a shot at the left tackle gig. Then Searles will probably move over to the right. And that, again, you're just asking a lot of guys to play out of position. You're putting a lot of pressure on guys, and it's been very difficult for Sam Bradford to get anything going without a solid, you know, without solidity and continuity and a pass protection on that line. At the same time, Carson Palmer is not right. Carson Palmer has not been able to complete passes downfield. He's not hitting the guys that are open, and you know, just forcing it to Larry Fitzgerald only does so much for you. And again, you're looking at this Minnesota Vikings defense where you go, they have one of the best pass rushers in the league. They have stars at every level of the defense, really. And you know, Harrison Smith, I still think is one of the most underrated players in the league, one of the best safeties in the league. And Trey Waynes is coming along at cornerback. So how do you score points against them? And especially when you're an Arizona Cardinals offense that's been struggling to score points against anybody. The San Francisco 49ers are the worst defense in the league. They are wet tissue. They were bad. They've been decimated by injuries. They have no identity. They have nobody that scares you. And it was a nail biter. It was a nail biter against the San Francisco 49ers because Carson Palmer couldn't put up points. He couldn't outscore Colin Kaepernick. When Colin Kaepernick, they had, I think it was 4 yards of total offense at something like 5 minutes into the second quarter. Like this graphic, a screen cap went around Twitter, like Arizona Cardinals total yards 112, 49ers 4. And it was like, oh my goodness, you know, this completely incompetent, but the Cardinals could not put any distance between them and the 49ers. Now you turn around and face the Vikings. I don't like this matchup for the Cardinals. But at the same time, this is Bruce Arians. I have a ton of respect for him. He's a fantastic coach, and they know this is must win. Even at 4-4-1, the Seahawks are 2 games ahead of them and streaking right now, just maybe the hottest team in the league. And they need to put distance between themselves and the Rams, for that matter. They're just trying to stay out of third place. So I think both teams need to win this to stay the course. But if Arizona doesn't win this, I don't see a path to the playoffs for them. Minnesota, even if they drop this, they're behind only on tiebreakers to the Lions. They've got a long schedule and 3 division games to make it up and get back there. So I think there's more pressure on Arizona, and I think it's going to be harder for Arizona to get the win.
Yeah, you know, all due respect to the Lions, I don't think we're going to see them separating quite like the Seahawks sort of appear to be doing right now. So we'll wrap up with Ty Shalter of Vice Sports and the Comeback Pro Football Weekly, SiriusXM. You can find his work all over the place, and we appreciate him spending some time again on the Pro Football Weekly podcast today. Ty, we'll wrap up. I do want to get back to that hot seat talk just momentarily, but before I do, because I believe the Lions are your hometown team, and I know you follow them pretty closely, just your general thoughts on where they find themselves after the bye and now in first place. Obviously, that's where they literally find themselves. But do you think that there is a viable path for them to finally win their first NFC North title? Do you think things are heading in the right direction with guys like DeAndre Levy and Darius Slay and Riley Reiff healthy again? Are things pointing up for Detroit?
DeAndre Levy fixes the biggest problem this team has had, which is linebackers that don't know how to cover. They don't understand where they're supposed to be. There have been so many coverage breakdowns, especially in the red zone. Tight ends have been walking in uncovered, and then just holes, literally. But there's been holes in the zones. You know, opposing teams have been able to go in and basically dictate the game and move the ball at will. You know, we talked about Case Keenum. Case Keenum threw for, it was like 324-3 and no picks. You look at this team, I think their opposing passer rating allowed was up in the 110s. And that was, again, Case Keenum, Brian Hoyer, Brock Osweiler, Yeah, Aaron Rodgers in there. But again, this is still a team that absolutely could not stop the pass. Yeah. And, you know, Stafford's been playing incredibly well. He's made up for a lot. He's covered up a lot of flaws. Pass protection has been iffy, though they're starting to get some continuity now. Taylor Decker, you mentioned way back at the top of the podcast, he's outperformed my expectations. I talked to him on SiriusXM during the draft process. Really bright kid. Really gets it, loves what he does. I didn't think he had the fluidity and the athleticism to be a left tackle, but he's definitely impressed me. Riley Reiff's made a great transition to right tackle. Health is obviously, he was hurt for a couple games there. They get him back. That's huge. DeAndre Levy's huge. Darius Slay, obviously emerging as one of the better corners in the NFC, if not the NFL. That's huge. But the NFC North teams and the NFC East teams are going to run a gauntlet of each other at this point. The Lions get the Jags this week, then it's hosting the Vikings, again, at the Saints in the Superdome, host the Bears, at the Giants, at the Cowboys, finish the season hosting the Packers. So depending on whether the Vikings, Bears, and Packers are laying down and giving them that red carpet to the division title, mm-hmm. wins are going to be hard to come by. So the NFC North, this looks like a division that could be won at 8 games or 9 games, maybe, just because of the tough schedule down the stretch. And right now, Matthew Stafford, 5 fourth quarter comebacks, 5 game-winning drives, 5 wins. He only needs 3 more to pass Peyton Manning's record for those games in a season. Wow. And you know, they've got 5 left, or I'm sorry, yeah, 7 left to play. So that's where they're at right now. It's all on Stafford. And if they do make it to the playoffs, if they do win that division, I think the MVP chatter, maybe not winning, but the MVP chatter will be more than deserved.
Yeah, rightly so. No doubt. And I'd be lying if I said I saw this coming with Stafford. He's been excellent for more than a year now. And I'd be lying if I said I saw the struggles of the NFC North collectively or the AFC North collectively going the way that they have. It's been really stunning. And I guess for real on the way out, Ty, I did say I want to just get to the hot seat talk quickly. You surprised me a little bit in this column just by saying that potentially another big-time loss could lead to, again, potentially a big if, but you could see maybe a head rolling, whether it was Mike McCarthy, you had Ron Rivera or Marvin Lewis in season. Do you see that as a possibility? I can't see Green Bay making any moves in season. I don't really see Cincinnati doing Ty, I don't see any of these teams doing it in season, but tell me why I'm wrong, and Ron Rivera in particular was the name that surprised me to be on that list.
I think I had a line in there at one point, like maybe the axe doesn't come, but like we're talking about the fate being sealed. A head could roll Monday morning,
that's what I
posed as the burning question. And it could be, and like I said, the kicker of the piece is, or maybe it'll just be Gus Bradley, because he could very well be 2-8 after going on the road to Detroit. And this is a team that's supposed to take a big step forward from 5 wins last year, signed a ton of talent. It was everybody's favorite sleeper team, and he's wildly underperformed. Again, this is Mike McCarthy. I mean, Packers fans have really had enough of this, and they're underperforming. The bar is too high. The Bengals, I mean, I think this is it.
Enough of Marvin Lewis, Ty. Let's do the same damn thing the same way every year. It gets to be a lot to watch.
After last week, after Monday night, every Bengals fan and every Bengals writer went, boom. That sound you just heard was the window closing. Yeah. Like, this defense is too old. You know, the players have all been there. It's been 4 years running now of losing, you know, having one of the best teams in the AFC and getting bounced in the first round. They're looking up at too many other teams right now, and they just don't look like they can finish strong, get the division win, let alone do anything in the playoffs once they get there. Then again, you're looking at a lot of age in the secondary, a lot of age in the linebacking core, and even, you know, as great as Geno Atkins is, and as great as he's been on a down-to-down basis, he hasn't been the consistently dominant force that you saw before, and there's not enough talent around him on that defensive line to make up for that. So, if they lose to the Buffalo Bills, that's 3-6-1, season's over, window's closed. I can imagine that being it for Marvin Lewis. Do they make a move midseason? I don't know, but I feel like if I'm Mike Brown, if I'm the Bengals organization, there's going to be a rush to the door. That's what we've seen this more and more and more as teams are realizing if you're waiting for Black Monday, then you're going to get your second or third choice of head coach because the top guy is going to be wooed immediately by the teams that made a move midseason. I don't necessarily think Ron Rivera is going to get the axe after, you know, if he starts 3-7, but this is, again, Super Bowl 15-1 turn around. You basically lose a couple cornerbacks and now the whole thing is completely imploded. And I mean, I certainly think he's won enough grace period to get that back. Right. But again, we've seen, you would certainly think that first team all pro Josh Norman under contract for a year would be allowed to finish out that contract. But Dave Gettleman decided, you know what? Nuts to this guy. Hit the skids, pound sand, Josh Norman. I don't care that I have you under contract. I don't care that you are already figured into my cap this year. Go play for somebody else. I could see that same kind of thing where, you know what, I've had enough of this. Let's change. If we're going to change direction, let's not wait to the end of the year. Let's do it now.
That is fascinating, Ty. I hadn't thought about it that way, but when you put it in those terms with the, you know, the short leash on Josh Norman, and, you know, Gettleman and Rivera have been through a lot, but that's definitely interesting stuff. I agree on Marvin Lewis. I do think that his fate already kind of seems sealed, but it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. Ty, I kept you for 5 minutes too long, but that was awesome discussion. I hope that you had a couple extra minutes. We certainly appreciate it on the Pro Football Weekly podcast, and make sure you're checking out Ty's work at Vice Sports, the comeback at Pro Football Weekly, in his hot read column, which is up now. And Ty, I hope you enjoy the weekend's games, and I hope you'll come back again. I'll try not to keep you as long next time.
Anytime, Arthur. My pleasure. Had a great chat.
All right, and we want to thank Ty again. A lot of fun stuff in that conversation. I do enjoy our chats on the Pro Football Weekly podcast. We'll try and make them a little more frequent if Ty is willing, and I'm guessing he is. So good stuff. Now let's turn the page and bring in Hub Arkish. I know he's had a busy day today, but taking a few minutes out for the PFW podcast. Let's see what's cooking with Hub right now.
I am doing just fine. It is our TV taping day, so we're between shows and getting ready to bang out the last one and eventually get home sometime this evening.
All right. Well, we set the bar pretty high on the Chicago Football Now show this morning, so I hope that the Pro Football Weekly taping and Comcast Sports Live can live up to that one. I know it won't be easy.
We'll see what we can do.
So, Hub, I wanted to just spend a couple minutes. We had Ty Shalter on the program, and he broke down some of the games, some of the best games of the Week 11 slate and a few other things, did a little bit of hot seat discussion. You had a couple good, I shouldn't say you, Pro Football Weekly collectively came up with a couple good Way We Hear It items this week. And one I want to discuss is Gus Bradley on borrowed time in Jacksonville. I don't think that's going to really surprise anyone, just given his record and where things stand. What surprises me a little bit, and we'll see if you're hearing things differently, do you think you can have Gus Bradley on the bubble without having Dave Caldwell sitting there right next to him?
Well, it's hard to say. Honestly, I think the trend in the NFL these days is where the GM gets a crack at hiring two coaches. Bradley would be Caldwell's first. I think that you have to decide, you know, one of the reasons that you'd be firing Gus Bradley would be because you believe he didn't do enough with the talent he was given. And you know, you have to judge Caldwell through a totally different prism. You look at the free agent signings. I thought that there was some silly money spent there, but quite frankly, they had to spend some money just get up to the minimum required four-year rolling average, and they did get some decent football players. You look at some of the draft choices, and, you know, you lost a year in development with Dante Fowler Jr. You're still not sure what you've got in Miles Jack. Jalen Ramsey is certainly looking like the real deal. So it's a very different way of evaluating. I don't think it would be stunning if Shad Khan decided to pull the plug if they went together. But what I'm hearing and what seems more likely just based on the way the league works these days is that it would be Khan and Caldwell. Caldwell's next hire would be his job breaker or job saver. If he gets it wrong, then he would probably be gone. If he gets it right, then you feel you've got the right talent guy there, and hopefully now you've got the right coaching-talent relationship.
Hub, I'm just spitballing here, and this may not even make sense. Again, we're doing this off the cuff. It seems to me that head coaches in the NFL tend to get second chances. Some of them are almost like cats with nine lives. You rarely see GMs, and again, cut me off at any point if I'm wrong here, if I'm going the wrong direction. But it seems to me that you rarely see GMs get a second opportunity. Do you think maybe there's a correlation? Maybe the GMs get a little longer leash the first time around because they rarely get a second shot if it doesn't work out?
Well, I think that's exactly what it is. The GMs get, and again, it's not a rule, but if
right.
you go back and study it, you'll see GMs get two, sometimes even three chances, you know, with coaches. Whereas with a head coach, once he's been fired, that's obviously it. Most, quite frankly, don't get a second chance. It really depends on how they were valued coming in, and in many cases, it depends on what they do after they are fired in terms of earning that second chance.
Right.
You know, you look at a guy like Jack Del Rio, ironically, we started talking about Jacksonville. He survived much longer than many expected he would in Jacksonville. But then once he finally got fired, he had to spend a fairly significant amount of time becoming a successful defensive coordinator again before he got another shot. You know, you look at the real exception to the rule is a guy like Lovie Smith, who lasts 9 years in Chicago, gets fired, and then immediately gets hired and put in charge of Tampa Bay, but then also immediately gets fired because Tampa Bay gets cold feet and second thoughts literally, you know, a year and a half, 2 years after bringing him in. So I think it's just a different measurement. I think that GMs get their two or three chances in their first job. Head coaches, it's one team at a time.
Okay, interesting stuff. Hub, let's spend a couple minutes just hitting on a few of the games that interest you the most this week. I'm going to take a guess that Philadelphia heading to Seattle and Baltimore heading to Dallas are probably near the top of the list. We didn't talk about the Texans and the Raiders in Mexico City either earlier on the podcast. So maybe of those three, what jumps to mind immediately of what kind of, you know, interests you the most?
Well, I start with the Houston and Oakland game in part for obvious reasons because it's the matchup of the two teams, I guess, with the best records. When you look at Oakland at 7-2 and Houston at 6-3,
right.
The other two games don't quite match that record-wise. But there's another piece that people aren't talking about. This seemed like a great idea when the NFL decided to play this game in Mexico City. I believe it's been 10 years since they did it before.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that there's been an election, and we, being the American people who provide the National Football League, are not the most popular guys in Mexico right now. And there has been some concern voiced in some corners that there could be some demonstration here, there could be some protest, but it's a little hard to know how this game, even though obviously these teams and these players shouldn't be punished in any way. And we know there are good NFL fans down there, and sure the game will come off fine. But there is some concern as to what's going to be going on the periphery. And so in a couple different ways, it's an interesting game to watch. At the end of the day, though, the football piece of it I find fascinating because it is one of those classic matchups. The Houston Texans, not very good on offense, awful at quarterback, but still very good on defense, not dominant as they were before J.J. Watt went down. And with Oakland, you've got the flip side. It's one of the more productive offenses in the NFL. It's an awful defense, and so you wonder if that'll help Houston get healthy. I think there are more pedigreed players at Houston, but that doesn't mean there's more talent at Houston. Then you get to the last piece of it, which is if the Oakland Raiders are 5-0 on the road, Houston is awful on the road. Now, technically, the home game for Oakland, let's be honest, it's a road game for both.
So, right.
You know, the one more piece, though, it's a much easier trip for Houston than it is for Oakland. It's probably a little more comfortable situation with a much larger Mexican/Latino population in Houston than what you find in Oakland. So there's all kinds of little side stories here that I think make this game fascinating. And then the last piece is, remember, three years ago, Houston Texans took Jadeveon Clowney in the first round. That turned out to be a wise choice. I think leading Blake Bortles on the board for Jacksonville. But then with the first pick, I believe it was, in the second round. The first pick in the second round, Houston, I don't remember who they took, but I know it wasn't Derek Carr. And it was in large part because of the legacy of his brother, David. Later stepped up next and took Derek Carr.
Right.
His problems for 3 years now. And right now, even with the big money spent on Brock Osweiler, our quarterback, and there's a lot of people in Houston who still aren't happy that Rick Smith and the Texans passed on Derek Carr, but those are probably the same people who 3 years ago were screaming, "Don't you dare!" after the frustrating experience with David Carr.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think they took a guard, Suofilo or something like that. I'm screwing up the pronunciation, but I believe that was the first pick of the second round that year. You could probably take it a step further. I'm sure there are some, although it's starting to trend upward for Jadeveon Clowney. Some Texans fans who I'm sure would have preferred Khalil Mack, and in a certainly revisionist history, it plays into that, because I don't think anyone had Khalil Mack as the top player on the board. But Hub, I also found it kind of ironic that Houston's put all their money on offense this offseason, and you just alluded to how bad it is. Oakland put all their money on defense, and that's one of the worst in the league. So just kind of funny how that's played out. Nonetheless, both of these teams in first place in their division and facing a huge game. I wasn't going to mention this, but you kind of just got me thinking, and I don't know if you've had a chance to work your sources enough yet to really have an opinion on this, but Tony Romo, some have speculated perhaps if the Brock Osweiler experiment continues to not work for these final seven, I guess it'd be seven games, maybe Tony Romo stays in state and heads to Houston. Have you had a chance to put any feelers out on the future for Tony Romo yet, or are we a little too early on that?
Well, I think we've all, thought about it even prior to this week's developments and talked about it a little bit. I do want to take a moment to say that I thought his statement, it wasn't a press conference, but his statement was one of the classiest things I've seen in the National Football League ever, and certainly in the last 5-10 years. Everything you would want in a leader of your football team and a great football player. Now, he is a flawed football player. He is not perfect. Remember, this is can't win the big game, Tony. There are issues here. This is a chronically injured player. And yeah. Most importantly, what I think everybody's missing is he comes with a contract that's not tradable. I think it's like $20-25 million, and it's just a ton of dead cap money that comes with it. And yet, the only way for Tony Romo to move on seems that the Cowboys would have to release him, eat their portion of the dead cap money, and then he'd have to go somewhere as a free agent and sign a new deal. Because I don't know a lot of teams that are in the kind of cap situation where they could make a trade like that.
Yeah, and Jerry Jones said today, not even in consideration letting Tony Romo get away. I believe he said he believes that he is still going to win a Super Bowl in Dallas. So I don't know how that all works out in old Jerry's mind, but it will be nonetheless obviously fascinating to see what happens with the franchise's all-time passing leader. Spending just a couple more minutes here with Hub Arkish. And what about those other two games? Did the Seahawks... What else do they need to convince you of? Not that they're looking to convince you of anything specifically, but just your takeaway from what they did in Foxborough and how they follow it up now on a short week and welcome in an Eagles team that got right a little bit with a huge upset of their own over Atlanta.
Yeah, just to put a quick wrap on the Tony Romo Dallas Cowboys thing, kind of like our new president-elect, Jerry Jones says a lot of really stupid things that are obviously stupid to everybody but him. Romo is not your guy because Dak Prescott is. I'm not sure how Tony Romo is winning Super Bowls for you, but different subject for a different time. So, let's be clear on something. The Seattle Seahawks surprised everybody, including me. They are clearly a better football team than I thought they were. And as a matter of fact, in our Pro Football Weekly Power Rankings this week, had to rank them number one and the Cowboys number two
right. Because
the Seahawks are a more complete football team. That said, they were not clearly better than the New England Patriots. That game, for most part, was a draw. Came down to, I thought it was a blown officials call on the third play from the end. It was clear pass interference. It was worse than pass interference. It was assault and battery on Cam Jampler. It's the Gronkowski problem. It's the Cam Newton problem. I guess you're not going to get some calls sometimes. So, no complaining. There were controversy calls both ways. Yeah, Seattle deserved to win the football game. I'm not challenging that. I'm saying they're not clearly a better team than the New England Patriots. And as a matter of fact, if they were playing again tomorrow, I would probably still take the Patriots. And the reason I explain that is it leads me to this football game. They've got a big problem on the offensive line. They got away with it in the second half of that game against New England. I think New England is probably kind of scratching their head a little bit about that Jamie Collins trade. Yeah. Now that they see that they're struggling to stop the run a little bit. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of time that can all sort out. The strength of Jim Schwartz's defense is that front four, and particularly Fletcher Cox. And there's nobody on that Seattle front that's going to match up with Fletcher Cox. And there's probably nobody who can block Brendan Graham or Connor Barwin, So it's going to be very, very interesting. Seattle doesn't lose at home. We know that. That Seattle defense is probably going to be a nightmare for Carson Wentz. You know, the rookie is hanging in. He's learning, getting better, you know, occasionally a half step backwards. He doesn't have the kind of weapons you need to challenge that Seattle defense. So I think it's a fascinating matchup, and I can make both the positive and the negative arguments for both teams. At the end, you know, unless you're a glutton for punishment like me, I think you kind of got to take Seattle because, A, we know they have the better team and we know they're at home. But I think anybody who doesn't realize that Philadelphia is going to show up in this one, that Philadelphia's got a real shot at getting themselves, because the Eagles have surprised us every time we've tried to write them off so far this year. It's a great football game. Going to be a really physical football game, and I'm really looking forward to watching it.
Just an outstanding performance by Jim Schwartz's defense last week against Atlanta. Hub, before we put a ribbon on these this podcast with the Baltimore-Dallas game, just two quick follow-ups. I liked it that the referees swallowed the whistle on that final play. I hadn't really thought about the fact that it was Gronk and maybe it was the Cam Newton treatment or a lack thereof from the officials, but I guess just in that moment, and maybe the officials were thinking, gosh, I don't know how much more heat we can take through the first, you know, 11 weeks or whatever it is, but I kind of like the no call there. And then we're not going to spend a lot of time on the biggest mismatch of the week, New England going into San Francisco, but I will say if Colin Kaepernick gets loose as a runner in that game, you have to think that whatever you just said about Jamie Collins is only going to be amplified, and they're going to be wondering if they made a mistake letting go of the one guy who can maybe run sideline to sideline trying to defend Kaepernick. So those are my two thoughts on that. And then let's just close with Baltimore and Dallas, and another strength versus strength. We're going to be treated to the number one run defense, actually the number one defense overall, going in to see Zeke Elliott, Dak Prescott, and the Cowboys coming off just a win that was nothing if not impressive in Pittsburgh.
Well, yeah, real quick, Arthur, on your thoughts about swallowing the whistle at the end of the New England-Seattle game, I get where you're coming from. I know a lot of people feel the same way. Here's my issue with it. The rules are the rules. That was a blatant interference. So with the quality of officiating the way it is now, encouraging the officials to decide when they're going to make calls and when they're not is only going to make the situation worse, not better. So, you know, definitely two schools of thought on the thing, and I understand where everybody's coming from. As far as the Baltimore-Dallas thing, again, the Cowboys, better than anybody realized they were going to be. They're certainly better than I thought they were going to be. And you turn it around, I don't think Baltimore is as good as their record. I know that they've piled up, a four-game win streak now. They got to the 3-1 start. They dropped three, and now they've won four. But other than the Pittsburgh game, Ben Roethlisberger, you know, barely back from knee surgery, there's really not a quality win in there. That said, I do think that the Baltimore defense is going to be the best defense that Dallas has seen this year. So, because they're very good. They're not as good as the Ravens defenses of a few years ago, the Super Bowl team, but they are very, very good. And they've got a chance of slowing the running game. They're not going to stop it. And they've got a chance of putting enough pressure on Dak Prescott with a controlled Dallas running game that will challenge him in ways he hasn't been challenged so far. I'm not doubting him at this point. I'm just saying he's still a rookie. There's still more to learn. The flip side of it is that I thought that the Steelers, with Big Ben still trying to get in a rhythm, exposing that Dallas defense a little bit, been waiting for it to happen. They haven't really played an explosive offense, and Pittsburgh hung 30 on them. And quite frankly, as much as people can rave about the fake clocking from Ben Roethlisberger, I think you see now it was a mistake. They left too much time on the clock. You know, you'd been better off clocking, taking another minute off, and then scoring the touchdown. That said, you know, Baltimore doesn't really have the kind of offense that's going to challenge that Dallas defense. So this is absolutely a classic strength against strength and weakness against weakness. The one thing I will say for Baltimore, and I know this is probably not brilliant analysis, but it is reality in the NFL, it is impossible to win six games in a row, seven games in a row, eight games in a row. They're coming off their biggest win of the year in Pittsburgh. They're back home. Teams come up a little flat at the strangest times for reasons we don't understand. This just feels like a trap to me for the Dallas Cowboys. They're the better team. They should win at home, but I'm not going to be stunned at all if Baltimore doesn't have everything they can handle.
I totally agree with you, Hub, and I think, you know, ironically, Tony Romo holds the press conference or gives the statement saying he's not going to be a distraction to the team. it's all anyone's talking about this week. Is there a chance that they're distracted by that? And Dak Prescott, who has been unflappable, and we'll close on this, but I'm just curious to get your thoughts. He's been unflappable at every turn so far. He's never had the franchise passing leader holding a clipboard behind him. How do you prepare for something like that? It's going to be a kind of surreal thing, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, I hear what you're saying, and you're right, but I actually think it's a good thing, not a bad thing, because, A, the fact that it's all everybody's talking about allows Prescott not to worry about it. He's just focused on what he's got to do. Sure. Let him talk about Romo. Let him talk about what he said. I thought Romo was pretty clear in his message, and that's what Prescott needed. Again, as far as having him holding the clipboard for him, it's not like there's any chance that Jason Garrett's going to say in the third quarter, oh, Prescott just threw a pick, I'm going to Romo. I mean, that's Prescott's job right now. And so the only thing he's got to worry about is going out and doing that job. If they were going to, they've got plenty of room in the standings. If there was going to be a change from the current situation, it isn't going to happen in the middle of the game. So short of injury, it's up to Dak Prescott to go out there and play his game. And I don't see any reason, really, that Romo should be a distraction for him.
Yeah, Prescott should be more worried about Terrell Suggs and you know, Timmy Jernigan and the rest of those guys than Romo behind him. And to his credit, Jason Garrett did say as much this week. They're not looking to give anyone a quick hook. They don't want Prescott looking over his shoulder. So great stuff, Hub. I know you're up against it. You got to go record your final TV show of the day, but we'd love to have you on, and we'll look forward to doing it again. Same time, same place next week. Sound good?
All right, Arthur. Take care.
And another sincere thank you to Hub Arkish for being on the program. We apologize if there were some minor audio difficulties in that interview. Hub taping, I think, at the Comcast building, and I think service was going in and out a little bit, but he had a lot of good stuff. I didn't want to cut him off, so hopefully that was okay. Hopefully you guys enjoyed today's podcast. I enjoyed bringing it to you. As always, I'm your host, Arthur Arkish. Want to thank one more time Ty Shalter of Pro Football Weekly and Vice Sports and The Comeback. You can hear his own podcast on SiriusXM. Also need to thank Hub Arkish. Like me, like Ty, you can read his work at PFW. You can hear him pretty much all over the airwaves and on various channels on your television sets in Chicago and around the country. And most of all, we have to thank you, because we can't do this podcast without you. And very appreciative that you are back to hear about all of what we think are some of the best angles in Week 11. Now it's up to you to go enjoy the action on Sunday, and we'll come back here next week and try and recap and look ahead. So that'll do it for today's Pro Football Weekly podcast. One more reminder, if you haven't done so already, head over to iTunes, make sure you are subscribed, and leave us a comment and a like while you're over there. That's going to do it, guys. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. On behalf of the Pro Football Weekly podcast, we thank you again. We'll talk to you next week.